welcome to ACB Radio Blind Line. My name is Jonathan Mosen. If you're a first-time listener to Blind Line, we've been around a wee bit before on MBS FM, which was a shoutcast station that I used to run for a bit of fun. And here we are on ACB Radio. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's Saturday, December the 4th today in most of the world, and I'm pleased that you could join us. On the program today, well, shortly, as we do as part of the Blind Line format pretty much every week, we'll have an interview with a key player in the blindness community. This week, we're going to follow up on many conversations that we've had over the weeks on Blind Line during the call-in part of the program, where people have talked about their usage of Linux and other derivations of Unix. Some people who are using that kind of system are using a program called Emacs Speak, which is developed by T.V. Raman. And Raman has a PhD thesis in mathematics, which in itself was about some interesting work to do with speech synthesis and the processing of visual information into a way that is attractive in an auditory format. So we'll hear briefly about that, but predominantly we're going to talk about Unix and Emacs Speak, because they've just released version 11 of that program in the last few days, and that offers a self-contained system that gives you access to Unix under Emacs, and because it does include a software speech synthesizer. So we'll talk about that shortly, and if you want to know a bit more about Unix, what it is it worth the bother, is it all cryptic commands, well, you'll find all the answers to that when we speak with Raman in just a moment. After that, it'll be your chance to have your say, and there's certainly a lot to talk about this week. Since we launched ACB Radio at exactly midnight Universal on December the 1st, we've been inundated with positive comments. It really has been phenomenal. And it's also been great to know that for a couple of days there, we had a perfect score from those who chose to launch our station from the Live 365 directory and rate it. And for a while there, we were perfect score. Now we're down to something like good or very good, but that's still very impressive. The email box has been flooded, and we really appreciate your support. We've had lots of good ideas for programming, but we're still looking for more. If you are interested in running your own show, it doesn't have to be about blindness content. What we're really seeking to do is build up a radio station that is run by the blind for the blind. So if you want to do a music program or perhaps something different, bounce the idea off us, and we'll be certainly interested in following up on that. But time now for this week's interview. T.V. Raman, a fascinating man, a very clever man, the author of Emacs Speak, which has just released version 11. I began by speaking with Raman about his blindness, and we found out that he wasn't blind all his life, having gone blind at the age of 14.
I could see a little bit until I was 14, and looking back, I was probably always legally blind. So I never thought of myself as being blind until I actually lost what little I could see. So, I have not seen since the age of 14.
I suppose that as a youngster, people don't really want to come to terms with that, do they?
Well, it's not so much coming to terms with it. I mean, you know, it wasn't that. Well, you know, I could see and I could read and I could write, and you know, I went to a school with other kids, and you know, I never thought of myself as being fully, as having a, you know. Whereas after I lost my vision, then, you know, I went off and learned Braille and, you know, readjusted to that, and that was it. You know, it was not that it was a taboo against being blind or something, but, and to a large extent, I think that was actually the right thing, and I was very fortunate that that's how things worked out, because thanks to that, I actually went to an integrated school relatively, you know, as opposed to going to a special school for the blind. And, you know, personally, having gone through that, I think I sort of believe I got a significant advantage. I grew up in India. I came to the United States in 89 for graduate school.
So did you do your PhD thesis in the US?
At Cornell, yes.
And what got you interested in the whole area of speech and the way that it's processed and interaction with computers? It must have been a pretty interesting thing to do a PhD thesis on.
It was a serendipitous thing, actually. I was, my background is mathematics. I'm a mathematician by training. And I was actually looking at robotics and vision, and you know, sort of looking for thesis topics. Yeah. And I was doing a course on computer algorithms at Cornell. Yeah. And the instructor was in the process of writing a book. And we were using, you know, early draft chapters of that book as lecture notes. So he would just typesetting the book in LaTeX, and he would hand out these four or five typeset pages at every class. that, you know, I had a screen reader at the time. I just sort of got in a screen reader. This was 1990 DOS screen. I never really used DOS even then. I basically would use the DOS PC as a terminal to a Sun workstation. Anyway, so he had these notes online that he was typesetting, and I said, well, give me those files, you know, screen reader will read it to me. So he did, and, you know, I sort of got, opened one of those files and made the screen reader read it, and out came a pile of gibberish. I said, well, so here's an interesting problem to solve, and I sort of started hacking something on the side. So I think, you know, you take a LaTeX file, and LaTeX, for those of you who are not that familiar with it, it's basically a markup language. And, you know, in 1999, 1980, 1998, 1999, in the era of the markup language with HTML and XML becoming big things. But in 1990, LaTeX was the markup language that the academic community used for writing their math and science books. They still do use it. And so, you know, I said, well, there's this markup language, and there's the software on the computer that takes that information and typesets it and presents it in a form that is pleasant for the eye to see. What does it mean to take that same information and format it so it is pleasant for the ear to hear? And so that, from being a weekend hack, turned into a PhD thesis. It was a fun thesis to do.
What does it sound like? How is it different, for instance, from listening to regular synthetic speech reading out a document?
It is synthetic speech, except that one way to think about it is, supposing I buy you a laser printer. So you have a laser printer, and then you have software that presents, you know, that formats things for your laser printer and produces beautiful visual copy. I give you a speech synthesizer. Maybe it's a very cheap synthesizer, maybe it's a very sophisticated synthesizer. But I give you a speech synthesizer. When you sort of take a screen reader or these other things that just send text down to the sky, it's like buying a laser printer and then printing out your document on a long ticker tape. Okay? Your documents don't look very pretty if you just took, you know, all your files as flat ASCII files and sent a long string out with absolutely no formatting and produced it on a reel of tape about 1 inch broad. You don't do that, right? You take your laser printer and you have software that formats your document so that you see it beautifully. And so on the synthetic side, what you can do, so you have fonts being used for drawing attention to things that are bold, headline set in a different font, you have paragraph breaks. All those things are done so that your eye can navigate around the document efficiently. And so on the audio formatting side, I do a lot of similar things. And the system that was built for the PhD was specifically optimized for reading mathematics and technical notation, where you play even more of those games in terms of, you know, laying out things to make complex notation. So, you know, you do an integral, right? Put an integral symbol, and you put a lower limit below, and you put an upper limit as a superscript, and then you put the function that you're integrating. Math notation uses a lot of the power of two-dimensional notation. And so when you try to speak that, typically if you go listen to a human reader speaking mathematics to you, all of that notational complexity translates into lots of additional words that are added to make it unambiguous. So I have to tell you something like the fraction whose numerator is a plus b, n's numerator, and whose denominator is c plus d, n's denominator, n's fraction, plus 1. Now notice that there were a lot of words added there. Now this makes what happens when you do this in any notational is that you cannot, the reason why you have concise notational systems is that the more concisely you express something, the better you can reason with it. So, for instance, on the audio formatted version, you would hear it say the fraction, and then it would drop in pitch as it entered the first nesting level, say A plus B, come back to the top nesting level of voice, say divided by, drop in pitch, say C plus D, then come back to the normal pitch and say plus 1. And you would immediately hear the nesting. And because these things like dropping in pitches or the voice going softer and things like that could all nest, so you could do nested superscripts. So it was e to the power x. And because it's a synthesizer, it can do it all consistent. You know, it can do it the same way today as it will tomorrow. So what you end up getting is a very effective auditory notation that works as well as written notation. And you can sort of carry this idea back to everything. I mean, you can carry this idea over to web pages where, you know, section heads sound different from anchors, and that's actually all done now in my current system using Oru CSS, which is part of the W3C cascading style sheet standard. So essentially a lot of this work you can think of as now that we have machines that talk and machines that can make sounds, what is it that you need to do for oral presentation to bring it on par with synthetic visual presentation? Because, you know, after the printing press got invented with Gutenberg, and even before that with scribes, the art of visual typesetting is something that has evolved over time. You know, to design these things and you know how to lay things out. And on the oral side, the only people who know how to present things in a way that is efficient for the ear to hear cleanly are the media folks, right? The radio people and the television people know this implicitly. But it's not synthetic, right? It's the CNN announcers who's reading it, and, you know, they are playing this music in the background to cue you to what they are doing, and they have all these jingles, and they're doing some very complex stuff. Now, the question is, when you have documents that are electronic and when you have the ability in the computer to do all that, what does it mean now to say format that information auditorily?
And one of the interesting things is that you've developed Emacs Speak, which I guess sort of implements some of these concepts, because I noticed that you're very careful in the documentation about Emacs Speak and everything that you say about it, never to term it as a screen reader, but more of an audio interface.
In fact, in the early days of Emacs Speak, I would like scream at anybody who dared call it a screen reader, because I do not. It's not a screen reader, because it sort of goes back to. So let's take that set of ideas one step further. So we said we've been formatting information and presenting it on paper. Well, we've been doing the same thing on the screen. Format information and put it up on the screen so that it's easy for the eye to see relevant information. So something interesting happens here, right? There is something called information, and then it gets presented by some program, either to a piece of paper or to the computer monitor, so to a two-dimensional visual display. Now, we sort of talked about this notion of audio formatting, saying you can take information and then present it in a way, manner that is most suitable for listening. And then you actually realize something else that is interesting, which is if you want to produce a good oral presentation of something, starting from the visual presentation is the wrong place to start from, because certain decisions have already been irrevocably made in the process of taking information and presenting it visually. So when you go back to the original information and then present that auditorily, in some cases, perhaps even in many cases, it might happen that the oral presentation ends up being a speaking, a rendering, a reading of what you would display visually. But the interesting places come where that is in fact not so. And a lot of places where the visual presentation, you sort of use implicit relative positioning to convey meaning, those things do not translate well when you take the visual presentation and seek them.
It's interesting you say that, because I noticed that with some of the newer screen readers, so-called, they actually have made a departure from reading the screen. If you look at the way that JAWS and WindowEyes in their latest versions handle the internet, they actually put the web page into its own buffer and reorganize things so that it's in more of a linear fashion.
They are looking at the HTML to an extent, which is the right way to do it. I mean, and things like WebSpeak or IBM Homepage Reader, you know, go even further than that by actually just parsing the HTML directly. The way Emacs Speak is built, that's how everything is done, including the web browser, you know, the mail reader, the calendar. So, for instance, you know, you use email, I'm sure, with your screen reader, and, you know, you bring up a mail message, and you sort of read, go through line by line, and it says, you know, from colon, with a from, and to colon, date colon. Now realize that this visual presentation of putting the name of the, you know, the mail header field lined up on the left hand side with colon and the field values on the right hand side is a very effective way of presenting that visually. So if you put that mail message up on the screen and you call one of your friends who can see and ask them what's that on the screen, he will not say from colon Jonathan Mosin to colon Raman date colon Mumblefax like the screen reader will. He will say, oh, that's a message from Jonathan Mosin to Raman sent on December 2nd. Now, what is happening there? What is happening there is that there is information, which is this mail message. That information has been presented in a manner that is convenient to be looked at. Your friend is looking at it, reconstructing that information, and then spitting it back out at you intelligently. Now, if you start with that information, the true original information being the mail message, in your efforts at synthetically speaking it, you can short-circuit this process of your friend looking at it, understanding the visual notation, and then speaking it to you. So, basically looking at that visual representation and coming back at the, you know, getting back at where that came from, sort of involves artificial intelligence. You have to be artificially intelligent and stuff. Whereas, if you start from the information source, you can produce the oral representation and in a much more reliable way without any guesswork. In the case of screen readers, even today, they are still doing a lot of guesswork. In the case of HTML, they don't have to do as much guesswork. In other cases, they are sort of, you know, winging it. They sort of are looking for idioms, essentially. So, when this application puts this thing beside this other thing, it means this. And then, you know, you sort of try to do it that way. So anyway, all of Emacs Speak is sort of built on the thing that, after all, it was the application that is running, the mail program or the calendar program or the web browser. It knew what the hell it was doing when it decided to display something in a certain way. Therefore, if you tell it, guy, look, I want you to speak to me, he can do a far better job of speaking it to you than waiting for him to spit it out on the screen, assuming you're going to look at it, and then have this other program come and try to speak it to you. It's important for you to know what is the information on this. Is it, you know, and in certain cases, it is important to know what it looks like. But to be efficient, if you are at an airport and your secretary is in your office looking at your computer, and you ask her, when's my next meeting? Is she going to tell you your next meeting is on Monday at 12 o'clock, or is she going to tell you the cursor is flashing on column 3, row 17? It's clearly the former, where there is a need to look at what the visual representation is. You should have the facility to do so. But to say that that's the only way you will work is sort of shooting yourself in the foot big time.
No,
I mean, it's a personal choice. You know, it's more efficient to work with information presented to you in a manner that is suited for the modality that you're working.
Emacs itself, as I understand it, and I'm not a Unix or a Linux user, is a text editor under the Unix operating system, is that right?
Well, depends on whom you ask. Many people who criticize Emacs sort of call it an AI project gone out of control. Emacs, at its core level, can be thought of as a text editor. But if you're using Emacs Speak, you're actually not using it as a text editor. You are essentially using it as your interface to the whole system. To understand this idea, you have to step out of the PC, DOS, Windows world a minute and sort of understand the overall philosophy of the Unix. Forget Emacs or not. In the DOS world, you sort of had a very, very primitive command line interface, fairly brain dead operating system, minimal services, and you had a 24x80 character display. And then over time, the graphical interface was added to it. And as the graphical, and interestingly enough, what happened was, at the time the graphical interface was being added to it, a lot of other things that ought to have been there in the first place, like networking, were also being added to it. And a consequence of that is that in the DOS Windows world, a lot of things that don't have to be are intricately tied up with the windowing. And a second consequence to that is that there is only one interface, only one user interface to the system, namely the windowing system, and a single windowing. Now Unix, on the other hand, is a different philosophy, evolved in a different way. Long before graphical interfaces ever became feasible on every desktop, Unix had networking. Networking was a first-class citizen. And you could do all the things you're doing on the internet today, 15 years ago on Unix. You know, you could not on the PC until 94. You had to actually install Win 3.11. The difference between 3.11 and 3.1 was 3.1 didn't have a TCP/IP stack. This is why you had Windows for Workgroups. What that gave you was a TCP/IP stack. So a lot of the networking related things, a lot of the multi-user facilities, a lot of the multitasking facilities, all of which in the PC, DOS, Windows world came along with the graphical user interface, were present in Unix land before the graphical interface. A consequence of this evolution is that in Unix, the graphical interface is just one way of getting at the core underlying system. And this is a separation that Unix has managed to keep. So when you sort of read these statements that are often made of Unix is easier to administer via scripts, Linux boxes are more scriptable, Linux boxes are better suited for servers because they run headless better, Linux boxes are better suited for servers because you can stick them in a cupboard and have plenty of them sitting there and write Perl scripts to manage all of them. The reason all that is possible is that all of the system functionality that the operating system provides for you is available to you through a multiplicity of interfaces. One of those interfaces being a graphical interface. So, sort of having given you this sort of Unix philosophy overview, now let's sort of look at Emacs in the context of Emacs Speak as the, you know. So, basically on Unix, you have X-Windows as the graphical windowing toolkit, and then many, many graphical desktops built on top of that graphical user interface layer. But because of the separation that has always existed, all those graphical interfaces are essentially manipulating things underneath that are manipulable from other interfaces. And the power Emacs user, the way the power Emacs user uses Emacs, and if you are using Emacs Speak, you are de facto a power Emacs user. Otherwise, you're probably wasting, you know, otherwise you're probably not getting the best out of this. The way the power Emacs user uses Emacs is he uses Emacs as his interface to the system instead of the windowing, instead of using a set of tools that have, you know, that let him manipulate the system. Emacs is the tool that manipulates. So the way Emacs was put together is it's a text editor, as you said, to start with. but it has a Lisp interpreter built into it. And because there is a Lisp interpreter built into it, and the Lisp interpreter provides a very rich API, the Lisp interpreter basically exposes all of the operating system services to the Lisp, to the Emacs Lisp layer. So networking. So if you want to open a TCP/IP socket to something and read some bytes and write some bytes, you can do that with one Lisp call from inside the Emacs Lisp layer. So what does this give you? Basically, you have a very nice platform on which you can write a lot of interesting applications. And that's what people have done in the last 10, 15 years of Emacs. Emacs has been around for a long time. So using that set of calls that are there in Emacs Lisp, people have written mail readers. People have written web browsers. People have written, you know, spreadsheets. People have written many, many modes for editing. You know, specialized editing for C code, specialized editing for Java, an integrated development environment for Java. All the things that you would traditionally think as a separate program, right? So in the traditional PC world, you think of all these things as separate programs that run on top of the OS. But in the PC world, the operating system is Windows, which is in fact a user interface thing. So here if you think of Windows as the operating system there, then here Emacs is the operating system. In actual fact, what is happening is Linux is the operating system. Emacs is a layer on top of it that is providing user interface, just as Windows is a layer on top of Unix providing you a graphical interface.
So does that shield the user from the complex command prompts that Unix is famous for, or would you really have to be quite a power user to want to use Emacs and Emacs speak?
The Unix shell is command line driven.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The Unix shell is a much more powerful command line than any shell you have in the PC world. In fact, I had an NT machine at home as a hacking machine for a couple of years, and the only way I could use that machine as a real computer was to first install Bash on it. Bash is the GNU born-again shell that Cygnus now has running on NT. It actually makes NT look like a real computer. So when people thought, these are all common myths that, for better or for worse, have been propagated because, you know, the PC world likes to propagate those myths. That keeps people away from things like Linux. It has nothing to do with mind users. The Unix shell is a very powerful thing, and yes, because it's powerful, it has a very powerful scripting language, and yes, if you try to use all of its power, it can be daunting. The Unix shell with its command line is not the be-all, end-all application. In the Emacs speak world, in the Emacs world typically, and this is why power users of Emacs like Emacs, there are actually a lot of Emacs tools that under the hoods actually call the Unix shell with all its command line complexity, but at the Emacs layer exposed like single keystroke things. So, you know, at some level it's like pushing buttons. At the shell you might do an ls or you might do a cp to copy a file or whatever else. In an Emacs you have a little file manager thing where, you know, you mark all the files you want to do something to and you push a key and it does it. So this is basically the kind of way you would work in Windows Explorer or something. The significant difference between the Linux way of doing things versus this PC way of, you know, oh, there's an application, you push the Alt key and you find what the menus are. What that graphical user interface on the PC gives you is it does give you instant gratification. So when you pick up an application, as you said, you can do something with it. And today on the Linux side, for the general user with the various Linux graphical interfaces, they get that also. Okay, they get exactly that.
Do you have users that actually have switched from a Windows operating system to Emacs and Emacs speak?
By definition, everybody, right? Because every blind user gets Windows and jaws thrust down his throat. So every blind user who's on that Emacs speak list has used a Windows screen reader, has used a DOS screen reader. So you can post a message. To post to that list, you need to subscribe to it. And at this point, there are, you know, people who are non-technical users using it. But anyway, just so to sort of finish that thought about, you know, you pick up an application and you can do something with it. Where the Windows interface on the PC, where the Microsoft Windows interface fails, is it does not scale with the user. So when you pick it up as a user, you can do something with it initially, and you get instant gratification. But as you grow, and as you learn to do more, the system does not grow with you. Whereas this is not specific about Emacs speak. The reason why Linux is a more productive environment for the individual user is that, so depending on how much you use the system and how prepared you are in investing in becoming efficient, the sky is the limit in how efficient you become.
Is there a wide range of applications available in this environment? And particularly I'm thinking about multimedia, for instance. I do a lot of sound editing. I know that there are MP3 players in the Unix environment, and I presume
what
real
do
media.
I have MP3, I have real audio, I have MIDI. Sound editing, because this is again a philosophy difference between the PC world and the Unix. The PC world was sort of designed for companies to sell you monolithic shrink-wrapped tools that they put in a box and you paid them money and you got it and it did something. And by God, it was in the interest of anybody selling you that kind of a box not to really let you know how things worked, because if they did, you would figure out how simple it was. And so, basically, in the PC world, for everything you have a tool. So you have, you know, you pay $30 or $40 or whatever pound of flesh you pay for something like a sound editing tool. And there are a bazillion sound editing tools in Unix land, except that you don't think of them as sound editing tools because nobody puts them in a box and calls it a sound editing tool. So in Unix land, if you want to clip a sound, what do? There is a simple Unix tool called DD, which goes back to the 70s. It's a disk dumper thing. But guess what? It basically lets you specify a block size, how many blocks to skip, and what to cut, what to pull out. And just using this, people have built some very, very simple sound editing tools, because all you need to do is pull out the right bytes and then put the right headers. And yes, and the way tools get done in the Unix Linux world is typically not as a large monolithic thing for each task and then reinventing the whole kitchen sink inside that monolithic thing. The way these things are put together in the Linux world, in the Linux side of the world, is you build tiny pieces and you plug them together in whichever way you find most convenient. And that, again, is one of the reasons why I said systems like Linux grow with the user. Because in the PC world, again, somebody sells you these big monolithic blocks, and you can only do what they thought you should do with that monolithic block. As you get more proficient, you cannot mix and match those blocks to do other interesting things that nobody ever thought you would want to do. Whereas the reason why there is this explosion on the Linux side today is that because of this open design nature of, you know, everything is a little building block, and you go assemble the Lego blocks in whatever way you want. And when people have the freedom to do that, they make far more interesting, you know, Lego block assemblies than, you know, the single large box that some big company thought you should have in return for a lot of money.
As I understand it, there are various derivations, if you like, of Unix, and we're talking about Linux. Does Emacs Speak work exclusively in Linux, or can it work in
the myriad
of variations?
It works actually on all the Unix. That was an important, you know, that to me is something still important, because access tools on the Unix side have been sufficiently scarce, and I did not want Emacs Speak to be specific to any Unix flavor. And especially, you know, until a few months ago, I was using Emacs Speak on Solaris, because I had a Solaris workstation on my desk. Now I have a Linux box on my desk at IBM. But, you know, I've used it on Solaris, I've used it on Deck Unix, and there is nothing Linux-specific in Emacs Speak until the newest release. The newest release, the thing that is Linux-specific, is the software speed synthesis. But again, that is a Linux dependency insofar as that software engine may not be available on all the other Unixes. So this is basically it's actually the same speech engine that you get running on Windows when you buy JAWS today, right? This is the eloquent IBM OutLoud engine. And so that one, for instance, today you can't get on Solaris. So to use Emacs Speak on Solaris, you will still need a deck talk or something like that. But there is no dependency in the Emacs Speak itself on any particular brand of Unix.
What would happen if you're an existing Windows user and they're listening to you speaking and they're enthused about the power that Linux and Unix-based operating systems offer? If you wanted to try it, would you have to completely trash your Windows system and install Linux, or is there a way to have both operating systems on one machine?
Both operating systems will collab, will live happily on a machine together. You have to realize, though, that installing an operating system is not the same as installing a program. Installing an operating system is work. Okay? Today, when you get like Red Hat or Slackware or SUSE or Debian, Linux installation has actually become very easy. You put the CD in and it comes up with three choices and you pick it and it goes. But remember, when you have Windows already installed, you already have an operating system on your machine. You already have data on the machine. And a significant chunk of the effort involved in installing a second operating system is basically backing up your current stuff, repartitioning your drive, making space for the new operating system. So these are all not Linux problems. These are all problems that arise because you're going to run two operating systems on your machine and you already have one installed. So if you went to a shop and bought a bare PC with nothing on it, which a year ago used to be impossible to do, now it's only a little hard to do. If you bought a bare PC and started from scratch, you would actually install Linux much faster on it than you would Windows. If you installed both, you would still finish faster than you would if you start with a machine that already has Windows installed and did the work. Because again, you know, the repartitioning, backing up, all that takes time.
There's a lot more talk these days about Unix. Is it possible now to go into a shop and ask for your PC to be equipped with some Unix derivation instead of Windows?
Companies in the United States are beginning to ship those kinds of machines. It's happening today typically on the server. So you can buy servers from people like Dell and IBM and so on, and they will give you Linux installed on it. There are companies that build Linux boxes. You know, there's VA Linux, but they again build slightly higher-end Linux workstations and servers also, but they are Linux boxes even for workstations. Tend to be slightly on the more expensive side. They're more workstations as opposed to home PCs. There are also small 1-person, 2-person companies all around the US, and I suspect probably in the Australia, New Zealand region as well, who will just install Linux for you for, you know, $40, $50 or something. My previous laptop, 4 years ago, I bought it with Linux pre-installed from a vendor, and I didn't even pay that anything extra for it, you know. I basically bought the laptop from that vendor as opposed to some other vendor, and I suppose they got the commission that Toshiba pays them or whatever. So it's getting easier. My current home machine, we actually built it. A friend of mine, and this is Silicon Valley, we went to Fry's here, which is a big computer store, loaded a grocery cart up with parts and brought it home and built it. And there, of course, we were able to build a completely virgin machine. I mean, this thing has only Linux and nothing else on it. And we had the machine up, and, you know, we assembled all the parts. We had the BIOS prompt up in 90 minutes. We stuck a CD in it, and in about an hour, the whole thing was running. So, it depends on which where you start in that whole process. If you already have a, you know, 6 gigabyte drive with 4 gigabytes taken up by Windows and a lot of stuff sitting there, I mean, of course, you could say, you know, and clearly you're not going to, like, trash the whole thing just to try something else. Then there is significant effort involved in backing up and, you know, making the two operating systems coexist and all that stuff.
If you were a new computer user, a blind person just starting out with a PC, do you think that Linux is the way to go, or would you think
I would actually say for the new computer user, right? For the new blind computer user, Linux is actually easier than for somebody who spent a lot of effort working their way around a Windows screen reader, because they've sort of picked up certain ways of working, and they've already invested a lot of effort in what my opinion is a rather convoluted, obfuscated way of working. But whatever that may be, in some sense, the person who is starting fresh is starting with a clean slate. I would actually say the person who is starting fresh would have less effort, which is sort of counterintuitive, right? Because there is this myth that has been, it's mostly FUD, right? It's mostly fear, uncertainty, and doubt that has been spread about, that's hard. No, believe me, you don't want that. You know, that's hard. Use this, right? Really, you know, you don't want that. You know, use this. And that's been done so much that people almost say, it's a beginner. You know, he should first use DOS and Windows. This Unix thing, this Linux thing, that's for the really sophisticated guy. Well, you know, I don't think so. I mean, that's just a myth. I mean, by the way, it's not as if I have never used a screen reader. Okay, I still have a copy of JAWS running on a Win98 box, just to see what that world looks like. And, you know, it's the contortions I see users going through to make those things work. And then, of course, they run around saying it's easy. But that's human nature, though. I mean, this is human nature, right? Once you do something that you believe is difficult, you will always say it's, you know, because you've now invested effort into it, you say, well, this is the right thing to do. And I may well be a victim of the same thing. So, in terms of saying, you know, Linux is easier. But that's how it is. That's personal bias and whatever else it may be. But I certainly wouldn't, like, say, it's a new user, therefore he shouldn't go this direction. He might actually be better off going.
I love reading the releases about Emacs Speak, because you've given them some wonderful code names, and a number of them are named in some respect or other after your guide dog.
Yes. See, the way Emacs Speak is developed is that I add things to it as I need it. So things that I find myself doing not efficiently in my day work, I go add things to it to make it more efficient. And every 6 months, I take a snapshot and release it. So basically, the thing is always stable and running on my machine. So, you know, the reason why I make a release every 6 months as opposed to every month is that if you make a release every month, then people upgrade at different times, right? Nobody wants to upgrade every month. So 10 people upgrade this month, next 10 people upgrade the next month. What then happens is when people, because everybody is running different versions, people can't help one another. So then when people ask questions, the only one who can answer them, you know, answering them is hard, right? Even for me, answering them would be hard, because I'd have to go back, look at what version they're running, and, you're running that, you know, do it this way. And of course, other users wouldn't be able to help one another either. So, releasing it about 6 months, once every 6 months, seems to be just about right. Because that sort of seems to fall within people's, you know, upgrade threshold, if you will.
And so then you release a new version, and within a month everybody sort of upgraded, and then, you know, when people ask questions on the mailing list, there are other people who can help one another, so sort of works.
You have a pretty active Emacs Speak users list who help each other out then?
Yes, yes. That is something that has evolved over the last 2 or 3 years, but it's sort of now gotten to the state where it can sort of maintain itself. I mean, I of course watch it and will do jump in and help people when there is a need, but for the simpler things at this point, you know, end users do it then.
Website that people could follow up on this interview, because it's, I must admit, it's got me fascinated. It's been a long time since I played with the Unix, and in that stage it was a shell with a telnet connection from a DOS PC, I think it might have been.
That's exactly what I used to do in a screen reader. My Cornell website is the place to start. I hate sort of speaking out URLs because people always spell some piece wrong or get some case wrong. So CS for computer science dot Cornell. Cornell is Cornell dot edu /home/Raman, Raman, and it's all lowercase. The best way to actually find me on the web is to go to any of the search engines and search for Raman and Astra. You'll actually find me. Astra is my guide dog, obviously. If you just search for Raman, Astra, and Emacs Speak, you find the page in about a couple of shots. But yeah, so the Cornell homepage is the place to start, and Emacs Speak has a nice little sub site under it, and there are, as you said, there are quite a few articles there sort of describing how all this fits together and why it fits together the way it fits together, because it's more a way of working and a way of doing things, and a significantly different way of doing things than, you know, just a program. I mean, anyone who sort of goes into this saying, oh, Emacs Speak, it's a screen reader for Linux, I will run Linux and it will be like my DOS PC and Emacs Speak will talk what's on the screen, they're basically missing the whole. Instead of doing that, they might as well dig out a 286 out of their closet, run Vocalize on it, and connect to a Linux. Yeah, that's turning the clock back to the 80s, but if that's what somebody wants, that's what they should do. So basically to get the most out of Emacs Speak, you sort of have to buy into this approach of saying, you know, this is how, I want to do my computing. And there is a lot to learn. You can learn as much as you need to. The nice thing is, as you grow, there is a lot of things in the system that you can grow up into. Whereas in more restrictive things on the PC, you sort of sense your head hitting the ceiling fairly quickly.
For someone who wants the next challenge, it sounds like this might be something that they can look into and perhaps find a thoroughly more rewarding computing experience. I really appreciate the time you've taken to talk to us about it. I'm sure it'll attract a lot of calls during the call-in portion of the program.
One final tip to your users. If they find all this interesting, I would really fervently ask them that they not send me direct email questions saying, how do I do this? If I do this, will that work? It's not that I just don't have the bandwidth. So they should use the web. Of course, if they have something that they want to send me email about, I would not discourage that. But more the thing I discourage is sort of the casual glancing at the web. Oh, I wonder if it does that, and then immediately dashing off an email message. That probably is a bad idea. And as I said, if users on your end sort of decide to go down this route, they should sign up for the Emacs Speak mailing list, and there are a lot of people who hang out there who can help. And it sort of helps build a community where, you know, people help one another as opposed to everyone depending on one person, because then you sort of run out of bandwidth, and then, you know, the amount you can add to the thing sort of goes down.